It looks like the government shutdown is coming to an end. Our long national nightmare is different.
That's about it. The nightmare shall continue.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Tonight.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, hi. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com, your mileage, of course, may vary. Glad to have you here with us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Frankly, what a week it has been.
Oh, my God, yes.
And it continues to be, whether we like it or not. But anyway, coming up today, we will have some election results news for you. Election results still, yes, coming up for you in a bit on today's broadcast from a contest on November 4th that was too close to call at the time. But it now looks like we do have a call today on that contest. And it is still more good news for progressives and Democratic socialists from last week's blockbuster blue wave off-year elections in about 30 states. And it is especially good news, I think, for our listeners up on KODX up in Seattle. We will get to that a little bit later. Also, Desi Doyen and our latest Green News Report later this hour as well.
Yep.
With several interesting stories, as usual, today, including a National Weather Service-related story and a 50-year-old This Week hit song that you almost certainly know and love, but had no idea that it was related to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association in some way.
Administration
in some way. I had no idea it was myself either, except thanks to Desi.
Yes.
So we will get to all of that. But I got to tell you, boy, this story just breaking on Thursday afternoon is kind of hilarious, at least until it isn't. But for now, I think it's pretty hilarious. Via AP, Donald Trump's corrupted Justice Department on Thursday sued to block new congressional district boundaries approved by California voters last week, joining a court battle that could help determine which party wins control of the U.S. House in 2026. The complaint filed in California, federal court in California, targets the new congressional map pushed by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom in response to a similar Republican-led effort in Texas backed by President Donald Trump. Now, I need to stop right there. What happened here in California is similar, as AP describes it, to the Republican-led effort in that both efforts seek to flip about five U.S. House seats next year. In Texas, their aim is to flip five Democratic seats to Republican seats in the U.S. House. In California, Newsom and the state's Democratic lawmakers hope to flip five Republican seats to Democratic seats next year in the U.S. House. But that is largely where the similarity ends. In Texas, which kicked off these gerrymandering wars when Republican Governor Greg Abbott and then the GOP state legislature there bent their knee to the direct pressure from Donald Trump to call a special session of the legislature to re-gerrymander what is already a gerrymandered U.S. House map in Texas that already gave Republicans an advantage in U.S. House seats far beyond the general makeup of the electorate in Texas, which is getting more and more purple by the year, by the way. But the main way in which that happened in Texas is very different from what happened in California. In Texas, Republican lawmakers who control the state legislature, they voted to gerrymander an already gerrymandered map in order to flip five majority-minority House districts. In California, Democrats who control the state legislature here voted to put the matter before voters because in California, we have a U.S. House map that is drawn by an independent redistricting commission, which is required to draw fair House districts based on certain fairness requirements. That is in our state constitution out here, which is why the state legislature had to first vote in favor of putting the matter before voters in a statewide vote on a new state constitutional measure known as Prop 50, and a vote which happened on November 4th when voters overwhelmingly voted in favor of this across the state by almost 30 percentage points, 65% to 35%, to temporarily set aside the House map drawn by the Independent Redistricting Commission in order to allow state lawmakers to draw a new and, yes, partisan gerrymandered map for the next few elections if voters approved, which they did, after which the Independent Redistricting Commission will eventually take the process back over after the 2030 census. And, by the way, that measure, voted on first by the legislature and then by a landslide of voters statewide, was only to be enacted if Texas and other GOP-controlled states gerrymandered their U.S. House maps mid-decade, which Texas did, and then Missouri did, and then North Carolina did, and other GOP states are considering doing as well. That process in California is very different from the strong-arming that happened in the state of Texas, where it was just state lawmakers gerrymandered state legislature, which made the decision without any voter input whatsoever. In California, it was first the state legislature and then an overwhelming vote of the people, of the voters. That is very different than what happened in Texas.
Yes, and now, of course, Republicans are saying, nope, voters, whatever you decided you wanted, we decide you don't get that.
Well, that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But when AP, when they report, just so you know, that when they report that California's new U.S. House map is, quote, in response to a similar Republican-led effort in Texas,
it ain't similar.
Right. It ain't. I mean, that's a very generally speaking that it's similar. I would argue it's not particularly helpful to news consumers and voters to use the word similar there. But just so broadcast listeners at least understand, hopefully now you do. Back to AP on this story, which is reporting that the Trump DOJ's lawsuit in federal court here in California sets the stage for a high-stakes legal and political fight between the Republican Trump administration and the Democratic governor in California. And here we get to the kind of hilarious part. Quote, California's redistricting scheme is a brazen power grab that tramples on civil rights and mocks the democratic process. That is a quote from Attorney General Pam Bondi in an emailed statement to AP, where she adds, quote, Governor Newsom's attempt to entrench one-party rule and silence millions of Californians will not stand. So I don't know. I don't even think I need to explain why that is so hilarious at this point, do I? Though I do understand that Pam Bondi, of course, is terribly concerned about brazen power grabs. She hates to see that. And, of course, trampling of civil rights. Oh, she can't sleep at night whenever anybody's trampling on civil rights. And, of course, she's very concerned about one-party rule in this country. Clearly, that's a great concern of Attorney General Pam Bondi. But I will note that the DOJ Civil Rights Unit is now headed up not by a civil libertarian, but by a Trump-appointed Republican activist attorney by the name of Harmeet Dhillon, who brought failed lawsuits against COVID-19 restrictions in California, and she represented Donald Trump in his challenges against the subpoenas from the House January 6th committee, the legitimate one that took place during Joe Biden's administration, the bipartisan one. So that's Harmeet Dhillon. She's been put in charge of the civil rights unit at DOJ. And now the DOJ civil rights unit is joining a case challenging the new map that was originally brought by the California Republican Party last week as represented by, guess who? Harmeet Dhillon's law firm out here in California. The Trump administration accuses California of racial gerrymandering in the state in violation of the Constitution by using race as a factor to favor Hispanic voters with the new map that the state voted for. So if you're having trouble following that, well, I don't know what basis that state lawmakers actually are using to draw their new U.S. House district lines after that vote on Prop 50, beyond partisan redistricting, which Donald Trump's own corrupted Supreme Court has already declared to be perfectly lawful. Now, I find it appalling. But we work with the Supreme Court we have, not the Supreme Court we wish we had. But what the DOJ is arguing here is that the new districts in California amount to a civil rights violation against white people, against white voters in California, where the majority of voters are still, by the way, non-Hispanic white people. So I guess it's a civil rights violation against the majority. White people make up about 57% of the electorate here in the Golden State, and it is that majority of voters whose civil rights are apparently being violated, according to the DOJ and the California Republican Party. The complaint asks a judge to prohibit California from using the new map in any future elections. According to the lawsuit, quote, race cannot be used as a proxy to advance political interests, but that is precisely what the California General Assembly did with Proposition 50, the recent ballot initiative that junked California's pre-existing electoral map in favor of a rush job rejiggering of California's congressional district lines. Prop 50, AP correctly notes with a bit of a snark here, I think, was Newsom's response to Trump's maneuvers in Texas, where Republicans rejiggered districts in hopes of picking up 5 seats of their own ahead of the 2026 midterms when House control will be on the line. Democrats, they report, need to gain just a handful of seats next year to take control of the chamber, which would imperil Trump's agenda for the remainder of his term and open the way for congressional investigations. Oh, boy, there'll be a lot of them into his administration. Republicans currently hold 219 seats in the House to Democrats' 214. So flipping just 3 seats from red to blue next year would give Democrats a majority in the lower chamber. Last week, when the state GOP's lawsuit was initially filed, the one that the DOJ joined on Thursday, Gavin Newsom's office was asked for comment. Their response, quote, we haven't reviewed the lawsuit, but if it's from the California Republican Party and Harmeet Dhillon's law firm, it's going to fail. Good luck, losers. So there's your pretty hilarious gerrymandering wars update for today. We will, of course, keep our eyes on that and all of the other gerrymandering wars, the battles in the war as it continues. Yes.
Yeah, with the DOJ, the Trump DOJ going after California, it does make me wonder how many other blue states that are also attempting this will also see lawsuits from the Trump DOJ.
And by the way, I should note that there are lawsuits against what the Republicans are doing in Texas and I think up in Missouri. We talked about that on this show with the group that is trying to challenge that redistricting in Missouri.
Yes.
Which might
People Not Politicians was the group.
Yes. And, you know, so we'll see. Lots of challenges going on. There's your update for today. And as noted, we've got some good election news for progressives, not necessarily Democrats per se, but progressives coming up for you in a bit today, following last week's off-year elections in which some close races are still being tallied even today. Yes, even out here in California, even Prop 50, where we take about a month to count our ballots.
Because we do it really carefully.
One of those races was finally called today. We'll have you, that for you a little bit later. But in the meantime, back in Washington, as you heard Stephen Colbert note at the top of the show, our long national nightmare is different. After we got off the air yesterday, the House approved the Senate bill to temporarily reopen the federal government after its longest shutdown in history. And Trump signed the bill in a late night Oval Office ceremony. As NBC News reported last night, President Donald Trump signed into law legislation that reopens the federal government and ends an acrimonious 43-day shutdown, the longest in American history. Trump's signature, which restores funding that has been frozen or halted for weeks, came shortly after the House voted to send him the measure. The Senate approved the same legislation on Monday when eight Democrats, well, actually seven Democrats and one independent who caucuses with them, peeled off and voted with Republicans to break a filibuster and end the shutdown. In Oval Office remarks, Trump blamed Democrats for the shutdown. Quote, "So I just want to tell the American people, you should not forget this. When it comes, when we come up to midterms and other things, don't forget what they've done to our country," he said. Okay, fair enough. I bet folks will remember quite a bit about what happened over the past 43 days, at least if Democrats do their job of reminding folks. The House vote came after Speaker Mike Johnson finally brought the Republican-controlled chamber back into session on Wednesday for the first time since September 19, nearly 2 months ago, in what seems to be the longest ever shutdown of the U.S. House itself ever, one that was not precipitated by the federal government closure. They didn't have to close the U.S. House. This was Johnson's own doing because of his interest in protecting Donald Trump from a vote to release the Epstein files, which is now going to happen anyway in about a week's time. Back to Trump here in the Oval Office, he said, quote, "Millions of American families went without food on their table." He was, I guess, hoping to that Americans don't notice or don't remember that his administration specifically chose not to use money that was already appropriated for supplemental nutrition assistance in the case of government shutdowns.
And even went to the Supreme Court to make sure people would go hungry.
And he defied several court orders before he even got to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
To beg them, essentially, to make him not make him release the money to, yes, put food on the tables of American families. That after Trump's big, beautiful budget adopted by Republicans earlier this year already cut $186 billion from the SNAP program that helps to put food on the tables of Americans, including millions of Trump voters, by the way, and children and disabled people and veterans. Trump continued, quote, "You had millions of Americans stranded in airports, their flights canceled and delayed." Well, that was true as well, since Donald Trump chose to not pay air traffic controllers during the shutdown. And his Department of Transportation chose to cancel flights in hopes of making the shutdown more painful for Americans. Mike Johnson could have called back the House and they could have had a vote and they could have said that the air traffic controllers shall now be paid. Mike Johnson chose not to do that. Donald Trump chose not to do that. He told reporters, "You had troops and federal employees wondering where their next paycheck would come from." Well, that also is true because Trump unlawfully used money from elsewhere in order to pay the troops a week or so ago, but not the other federal employees, thousands of which, by the way, although I know he's concerned about them, he fired them. Or at least he tried to, unlawfully, in hopes of making things as painful as possible, as he said out loud many times, for Democrats and, quote, Democrat programs. Even as millions of Americans are still wondering, by the way, how they are going to be able to afford their next healthcare payment after trillions of dollars in cuts to government subsidies for the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid and Medicare, which begin as of January 1. The legislative package that was signed by Trump on Wednesday night includes a so-called minibus, as opposed to an omnibus. It has three appropriations bills of the, I believe it's 12 that are required ultimately to fully fund the government and each year. Minibus provides funding through September for certain programs, September of next year for certain programs. It keeps the rest of the government open at current levels through January 30, when all of this could very well happen again in just weeks' time, though at least then there will be some funding in place for things like SNAP food assistance due to the minibus of appropriations, which also includes full funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as food stamps, to keep the program afloat until September, even if there is another shutdown at the end of January. More than 40 million Americans rely on SNAP. The legislation also provides limited protection for federal workers who have been under assault since Trump's inauguration. It reinstates thousands of government employees who were illegally laid off during the shutdown. And it ensures that there are no more reductions in force, known as RIFs, at least until the end of January. So they're going to bring back all the federal workers, and they can't fire them again, or at least they can't try to fire them again, or at least they can't try to fire them again legally or illegally until the end of January.
Well, there's no guarantee they won't try, but yeah, at least that's what the bill says now.
And it also provides back pay for workers who were furloughed or working without pay over these past 6 weeks. It makes all of them whole again. But the bill does not include an extension of enhanced subsidies under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare after Republicans held firm against extending those funds beyond the end of this year, which is the main reason why Democrats had refused to join Republicans in keeping the government open for the past 43 days. So that means that short of a vote to restore the Republican cuts to that program and to the other health care programs, more than 20 million Americans will see their monthly premiums spike as of January 1. 20 million Americans at a minimum will see that happen. Unless there is some sort of legislation before then. And actually, they'll see that earlier because premium payments for January are actually due by the end of December, when tens of millions of Americans will definitely see how much higher their premiums are now spiking thanks to the GOP cuts to health care. Those premiums are going to spike as much as 400% or even higher in many cases. I bet the voters will like that. Hopefully they'll remember that next year. I don't know if Donald Trump mentioned that at his signing ceremony at the Oval Office. Many House and Senate Democrats are fuming, of course, over the failure to secure health care funding as part of this bill. Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune has promised a Senate vote on a to-be-determined ACA funding bill at some point in December, but with no guarantees that that bill will actually pass in the Senate. Meanwhile, in the House, Speaker Johnson has not promised a similar vote. And, of course, even if both chambers somehow held a vote and restored the Republican cuts to health care, there is no guarantee that Donald Trump would sign that measure into law, which is why Democrats were holding out in the first place, at least until those seven Democrats and one independent turncoat actually undermined the entire caucus. In the House Rules Committee on Tuesday, Republicans rejected a Democratic motion to guarantee a floor vote on ACA funding in the House. And they turned away an amendment by Democratic Congressman Stephen Horsford of Nevada to redirect Trump's $40 billion bailout to Argentina. Yes, that happened during the federal government shutdown. He was happy to, he wouldn't feed people, Americans starving. He wouldn't promise to restore cuts to health care, but he was willing to spend $40 billion to bail out Argentina, where he has a right-wing authoritarian friend in charge, and instead put that move by Horsford, Congressman Horsford, was to extend ACA funding with that $40 billion to use it for Americans' health care. Said Congresswoman Teresa Teresa Fernandez of Democrat of New Mexico in response. I guess MAGA stands for Make Argentina Great Again. Although emotions are raw in the Democratic caucus over some of their senators caving, NBC reports, party leaders say the high-stakes showdown with Trump and the Republicans crystallized how Democrats are fighting for health care and affordability for millions of Americans. I hope so, but we will see. That economic message, they say, juiced turnout and propelled them to victory in last week's elections in Virginia and New Jersey and elsewhere. That part is almost certainly true. And it will help help the party in 2026. Say these Democrats, we will see if that is true. Shortly after Wednesday's vote, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries filed a discharge petition. No, not that one, not regarding the Epstein files, but a different one, a new discharge petition in a bid to bypass Speaker Mike Johnson and force a future floor vote on a 3-year extension of the expiring Obamacare subsidies in the House. So, again, a discharge petition is for when the House Speaker won't allow a certain matter to come up for a vote on the House floor. The House Speaker generally decides what is going to be voted on and what isn't. A so-called discharge petition can then be filed that if it is signed by a majority of House members, it then forces a vote on that particular piece of legislation. That's what finally happened on Wednesday in the House when Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva was finally sworn in following her special election in Arizona to fill the seat of her late father almost 2 months ago. The House was kept shut in order to prevent her from becoming the 218th member to sign the discharge petition to have a vote on releasing the Epstein files in the House. So a majority of members in the House finally signed it after she was sworn in and became the 218th member to sign it almost immediately after she was sworn in, forcing a vote on that matter as soon as next week. So in this case, this other discharge petition that has now been filed by Minority Leader Jeffries, it's to have a vote on whether to fund the Affordable Care Act or not after December for 3 years. But that, of course, would need the support, the signatures of at least 4 House Republicans before that could come up for a vote, at least via the discharge petition. Discharge petitions are always difficult to make happen. They very rarely work. It's remarkable, in fact, that they pulled off the one regarding Epstein. We will see if that can possibly happen again here on this Obamacare vote that is being sought by Jeffries and the Democrats. It seems like a long shot, but hey, so did the Epstein petition. By the way, if and when there is ever a vote allowed to restore these cuts to the Obamacare, to the ACA, keep an eye on how many years they end up extending it, if they end up extending it. The original, what Democrats were calling to make it permanent, and as they should be. But at some point last week, Chuck Schumer, I believe, offered to say, okay, well, if not permanent, how about for just one more year? Now, if they extend these cuts for one more year, there's a whole bunch of Republicans, in fact, more Republicans, there are more people receiving Obamacare, health care via Obamacare in jurisdictions that are controlled by Republicans than by Democrats. So there's a whole lot of Republicans that are on the Affordable Care Act. So in some sense, Democrats are doing Republicans a favor because there's going to be a whole lot of angry Republicans next year when they see how their health care costs are going up. And in making it permanent, well, Republicans don't have to deal with that. Now, Chuck Schumer said, okay, how about 1 year? That means that the matter will come up again next year, right around this time, right around the midterm elections, when it will become an election issue. So Republicans definitely do not want to do that. In response, there was some talk that Democrats were that Republicans were considering an offer to do it for 2 years so it doesn't come up in an election year. And here we have Jeffries in his discharge petition calling for a vote on extending them 3 years, which would put the expiration date smack dab in the middle of the next presidential election in 2028. Jeffries said on the House floor, quote, "We will fight until we win this battle for the American people. That's our commitment as House Democrats," he said, noting that the fight will end when either Republicans accept a funding extension to prevent premium hikes, quote, "or the American people will throw Republicans out of their jobs next year and end the speakership of Donald J. Trump once and for all." Speakership of Donald J. Trump. I see what he did there. So, I do hope that Americans remember what happened here, as Donald Trump suggested on Wednesday night. Though, as noted, they may get a reminder in, you know, just a few weeks when the new continuing resolution expires once again at the end of January. And by then, everyone who purchases their health insurance on the Obamacare exchanges will see how their monthly costs have skyrocketed thanks to the Trump Republican cuts, including the nearly 60% of Affordable Care Act recipients that live in Republican congressional districts. In fact, southern states, many of which lean Republicans, like Florida, Texas, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, et cetera, some of those states have some of the highest enrollment rates in the country. So we'll see if Republican members of Congress begin to notice that anytime soon. But in the meantime, it doesn't look like the shutdown did any good whatsoever for Donald Trump and his approval ratings, which a new AP NORC poll out this week finds to have dropped, quote, sharply since early in his second term. The survey was conducted after Democrats' recent victories in the off-year elections, so about 5 weeks into the longest shutdown in U.S. history. But it happened, the survey was taken before Congress took the steps to end that shutdown. But this poll shows that only 33% now of U.S. adults approve of the way Donald Trump is managing the government. 33%. That is down from 43% in an AP NORC poll back in March. That was driven, this 33% number was driven in large part by a decline in approval among Republicans and independents. And a lot of folks have been saying, okay, sure, he's unpopular, but when is his support among Republicans going to start peeling off? Well, newsflash, looks like it's peeling off, or at least starting to, right around now. According to the survey, only about two-thirds of Republicans, or 68%, say they approve of Trump's government management. That down from 81% back in March. Independent approval dropped, by the way, from 38% in March to 25% now. Those are, I will note, abysmal numbers. And they regard his management of the government. As to his overall approval ratings in the same new poll, well, those numbers are not much better. Just 36% approve now of his overall handling of the presidency. As to his management of healthcare and healthcare-related issues, well, he is bombing there as well, with just 34% of Americans saying that they approve of Trump's handling of health care in that November poll. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with, as promised, some election results and the Green News Report and maybe some other stuff. We'll see what we have time for, all of that. Straight ahead on today's broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Something happening here, but it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Yeah. Pay attention. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. There is something going on, it seems, at least if we keep our eyes close to these election results from the past week or so. We've got some new results along that score today. Katie Wilson, a community organizer and first-time candidate who pushed for higher taxes on the wealthy, will be Seattle's next mayor, unseating the incumbent more centrist Democratic mayor, Bruce Harrell, who conceded on Thursday following one of the tightest elections in the city's history. Wilson's election is a Pacific Coast victory for progressive Democrats that parallels Zohran Mamdani's rise in New York City, according to the New York Times. Wilson, who, like Mamdani, is a self-described socialist, focused her campaign on affordability, highlighting her own struggles to afford life in Seattle. She supported a capital gains tax to raise revenue, a move that was opposed by Mayor Harrell, stronger protections for renters, and improving public transit. Crystal Fincher, a Seattle-based political consultant, told Politico, quote, "There's a disconnect between what younger people are going through in day-to-day life today. I think there's a split in the Democratic Party about that, that we're feeling our way through." And I think she's right. In fact, though the mayoral election in Seattle is nonpartisan, at least on paper, both the incumbent mayor, Bruce Harrell, and Katie Wilson were both Democrats. And so that's sort of what this split is about. Wilson also pledged to do more to address homelessness, including fast-tracking shelter space. She was critical of Harrell's support for clearing encampments from public spaces around Seattle. She called for cutting police funding in the past, but in this campaign, she called for changing tactics by calling for adding more non-police response programs to supplement law enforcement, which seems like a smart compromise, frankly.
Oh, yeah, because right now, so many police officers and police departments are diverted to social issues rather than solving crimes, which is what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but for years, progressives have been, you know, calling a defund the police and so forth, which as a slogan, not calling for getting rid of the police, as many of the opponents have characterized it, opportunistically so. But when calling for police to be given less money, that's, you know, what they meant by defund the police, to in order to, like as you described, Desi, to allow non-police responses, for example, situations that called for, you know,
A social worker. A mental health professional.
Correct, rather than an armed response. So the incumbent...
And also, just by the way, I just want to point out and make clear that it is also not fair to the police. You know, that's not what they're trained to do. Mm. So let them do what they're trained to do so that they don't have to be diverted to things that they're not trained to do.
So in this case, instead of saying defund the police, she's saying give more funding to those social workers and psychologists and medical professionals and homelessness experts to augment what the police are already doing.
Right.
So kind of smart politics, it sounds like to me. The incumbent mayor, Harrell, had the support of Washington State's Democratic establishment, including the governor, Bob Ferguson. He had painted himself as a steady hand. He attacked Wilson's lack of experience, but voters, by a very narrow margin, felt otherwise about it. Despite expectations that Harold would cruise to an easy reelection, he first struggled against Wilson back in the city's top two style primary, where the top two vote getters go on to the general election. Harold lost that primary by more than 9 points. That was a hit to moderates who see their brand of Democrat as the party's way to regroup after their dismal 2024 results. And that's one of the other things that we're going to be looking at moving forward. You know, what's the response to what happened in 2024? Is it to go more moderate, to go more Republican-ish, or is it to go more progressive? Well, if the indications in Seattle, in any event, are teach us anything, it's to go more progressive. But it was a very close race. And, you know, the voters in this case felt like they wanted to go in the progressive direction. They were motivated in part, according to Politico, by changing economic circumstances and in part by Trump's reelection. The mayor was criticized, for example, for his relationship to local tech executives, a lot of those up there in Seattle, who but many of them also attended Trump's inauguration. Dean Nielsen, a longtime Democratic strategist in Washington State who backed Harrell, said, quote, "It's become somewhat emblematic of what's happening in the race. An establishment mayor who is being supported by a lot of those same people, those billionaire executives running headwinds into this vision of systemic change." Washington State Republicans, meanwhile, are reportedly approaching Mayor-elect Wilson in the same way that the national GOP is viewing Mamdani as an easy messaging win. Well, we will see if they are right about that. Before the polls closed on election night, Washington GOP Chair Jim Walsh predicted what would happen if Wilson won. She said, quote, he said, quote, "It would be very bad for Seattle, but very good for the Washington State Republican Party." Again, we will see. I'm not quite as certain about that as Republicans are pretending to be when it comes to election like Mamdani's in New York City and now Wilson's in Seattle. They're saying, oh, this is great news for us. We will see both of these elections in what could be the starting part of a wave of young progressive Democrats getting a real foothold in the party. Of course, they will have to succeed once they are on the job, so we'll see if they do. Wilson is co-founder of the Transit Riders Union, an advocacy group behind a number of local measures to expand transit access, increase renter protections, and add housing through new and higher taxes on the rich. She had never sought public office before this year and was prompted to enter Seattle's mayoral race only after Mayor Harrell became the public face of an effort to block a new tax on high earners to help pay for housing construction. The 43-year-old Wilson, according to the New York Times, is a Pacific Northwest avatar of the generational and ideological shifts rocking the Democratic Party. She lives with her husband and 2-year-old daughter in a rented 600-square-foot apartment. She does not own a car. She presented herself to voters as a champion of people, particularly of the millennial and Generation Z voters who expect to spend their lives struggling to do as well as their parents did. And, you know, a lot of those voters are, you know, coming of age and are going to be voting, and you know, they're paying attention. They're paying close attention. And when they see someone like Wilson who, you know, looks a lot like them, well, things could change in the Democratic Party.
We'll see, because remember, this is always, always driven by turnout.
As to the results here and why it took so long to call, voters in Washington State, they cast their ballots by mail, which takes a bit longer to tally up. They don't vote at all in person, for the most part, and ballots that are returned earlier in the state are counted before those that are cast at the last minute. In this case, it meant that early counts in the race actually showed Harrell way ahead. He was ahead comfortably. But as more and more counting happened, Wilson caught up with him and overtook him eventually, because historically, according to the New York Times, younger and more progressive voters tend to vote later, and at least in Seattle, therefore, they have their ballots counted later in the process. By Wednesday night, Wilson finally had a lead of just 1,976 votes. So just under 2,000 votes out of more than 275,000 cast and counted, but that was a large enough margin to avoid a mandatory machine recount under state election law. And on Thursday, with late votes now leaning heavily toward Wilson and not enough of them outstanding to close the gap, Mayor Harrell finally conceded. Wilson will enter office with a Seattle City Council, by the way, that appears primed to help her address the affordability question.
That'll help.
Progressive challengers also last Tuesday unseated the incumbent city council president and the city attorney in the election and won two other seats on the city council in the apparently very progressive town of Seattle. As we have been noting since last week, it was a very good election for not just Democrats, but the progressive left. I suspect we're going to see, as I said, a lot more young Mamdani and Wilson-type Democrats stepping up to run for something all over the country next year as we move into the 2026 cycle, and I am here for it. Quick break, and we'll come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report and another item or two as time allows. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Okay, I want to have a few minutes for a couple of interesting points. I think they're interesting after our GNR here. So let's get straight to it. Our latest Green News Report.
So I am here to ask, where is the accountability?
Developing nations demand rich countries live up to promises at UN climate talks in Brazil.
It's dead on arrival. And I also think it remarkable that he didn't promote it in his backyard in Mar-a-Lago. He didn't promote it off the coast of Florida. That says everything about Donald Trump.
Trump plan would open California to offshore drilling. Plus, thanks to NOAA, the Edmund Fitzgerald was the last commercial freighter to sink in the Great Lakes.
Thanks, NOAA. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
He did something even worse than that. He's now taking a big section of Palisades or some area, and he's going to build low-income housing where they used to have luxury housing.
Low-income housing instead of luxury housing? What is Gavin Newsom thinking?
His fire stuff is out of control. The forests are burning down all over the place.
Nope, I live here. No fires. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I don't know. Maybe Donald Trump has California confused with Portland. I guess we're all burning down with fires out here on the West Coast. What do you have for us today that is closer to reality?
Well, first, some science. October 2025 was the third hottest October ever recorded globally since at least the 1850s when record keeping began. It's a remarkable record during a cooling global La Nina weather pattern. In other news, at the United Nations climate talks now underway in Brazil, one of the key points of contention in the negotiations is climate financing. That is, how much wealthy nations who got rich off of burning fossil fuels should contribute to assist developing nations that did little to cause the climate crisis. Recent powerful, deadly back-to-back typhoons in the Philippines and Hurricane Melissa in the Caribbean have intensified those discussions. discussions. Vulnerable nations suffering from climate-fueled disasters and grappling with rising seas are demanding that wealthy nations fulfill their pledges to contribute to the newly established official loss and damage fund focused on helping them recover and adapt to accelerating climate impacts. Here's Jamaica's former climate minister, Una May Gordon.
There was significant economic damage to agriculture, tourism. So I am here to ask, where is the accountability? The people responsible, we are asking you to take responsibility and start to pay up.
Well, no wonder the U.S. didn't show up at that conference.
Yep. And the costs are mounting. In India, research indicates man-made climate change is altering monsoon rain patterns and increasing the frequency of intense storms and droughts. A new study estimates that in the decade prior to 2015, extreme rains and flooding in the city of Mumbai have killed at least 2,500 people every single year.
Wow.
And flooding during that decade caused more than $1.2 billion in losses. A different report concludes that India's Ganges River, the water supply for more than half a billion people, is in its worst drought in at least 1,300 years. Mm. A bit of good news on the loss and damage fund. In conjunction with the talks, Brazil unveiled a program this week to scale up public and private climate financing to more than $1 trillion a year. And Germany and Spain both committed to donate $100 million to the new climate investment fund operated by the World Bank. Here in the U.S., the Washington Post reports that the Trump administration is planning to open up the coast of California to new oil and gas drilling for the first time since 1984, and potentially off the Gulf Coast of Florida as well. California Governor Gavin Newsom in Brazil for the climate talks said the proposal for California was, quote, dead on arrival. Florida's Republicans in the past have opposed offshore drilling because an oil spill would devastate Florida's tourism industry. And finally, this week marked the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, a massive freighter that capsized in a ferocious storm on Lake Superior, killing 29 and immortalized in the hit song by Gordon Lightfoot. In the century before 1975, nearly 6,000 commercial freighters sank in the Great Lakes, but the Edmund Fitzgerald was the last. That's thanks to NOAA, America's preeminent science agency, which overhauled weather forecasting after that tragedy. NOAA, whose staff and budget has been slashed by the Trump administration, is still quietly saving lives through science.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early.
Thank you for that story, Desi Doyen. 6.5 minutes of two-line phrases, no hook, and yet it was one of Gordon Lightfoot's biggest hits. And the version that was released that you're listening to now was apparently the band's very first run at it, the first take of what he considered at the time to be an unfinished song. They had some extra time in the studio, so he said, well, here's a song that I was thinking of. You want to give it a try? They gave it a try. They did it in one take. That's the one that became like a huge hit.
Not just in one take. It was their literal first time
right.
to play the song together.
Yes, but of course, your story was about NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and their response, were they created in response, or they just changed the way they sort of
did? It was such a huge tragedy and such a shock to everyone that there was actually a law passed in Congress providing the funding for NOAA and the National Weather Service to expand weather monitoring around the Great Lakes. For example, they were only using at the time radio signals that basically the Coast Guard was would say, okay, we're over here 200 miles or 100 miles away or whatever, and here's the weather report here, and that is what sailors on the Great Lakes would use. Now there are more than 100 buoys that are set throughout the Great Lakes. I think just 138 on Lake Superior alone, so hundreds now that provide up-to-date, real-time information that is then used to help, and also we have, you know, more satellite coverage now, right, as well, to help make sure that the storms on the Great Lakes are forecast as they are happening, so that people aren't, the response to it was basically, now the Edmund Fitzgerald probably would never have left port had we had that same system in place.
Right, and this was after thousands of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and that was the last of them, the Edmund Fitzgerald. And by the way, growing up, I heard that song, knew that song. I assumed it was, you know, the Edmund Fitzgerald was a ship that sank hundreds of years ago or something like that. Had no idea. It was actually just the year before. It was 1975 when the Edmund Fitzgerald went down with 29 sailors aboard. And it was 1976 that Gordon Lightfoot's song came out. And apparently at the Naval Academy now, I think on the Great Lakes, to mark the date, I think when that happens each year, they ring the bell 29 times, once for each sailor. They ring it one more time for all of the other sailors that went down. And apparently they ring it once for Gordon Lightfoot.
Which is super nice.
It is
and
nice. Yeah.
I'd also like to add that it's unfortunate that there is no Gordon Lightfoot around to write songs about how Noah has been saving lives all this time because of that tragedy that helped be create a better weather forecasting system.
He didn't mention Noah in that song, did he?
He
should have. I mean, it's 6.5 minutes. You'd think he could have gotten in something about it. As a matter of fact, apparently he rewrites, or had been. He has now passed away just a few years ago. But apparently he would rewrite those phrases. Again, no hook, no chorus. It was just, you know, two-line phrases for 6.5 minutes. He actually rewrote some of them as they learned more about the tragedy to correct errors in his song.
And it became a worldwide hit, this song that completely defies all the rules of pop music and rock music.
There you go. All right, so a lot of stories wrapped into one there. Thank you very much for that, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other we have ever done since the beginning of time, since the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, you can download them for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button while you're there to help us stay on your public airwaves. You can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Just type that into your browser. You'll go right to it. It's really easy. You can make a one-time donation of any amount you would like, or an automated monthly donation also of any amount you like. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. You can find both Desi and me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky. She is
Green News Report.
And I am
The Brad Blog.
The Brad Blog. Very good. We will see you there until we see her next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Superior, they said, never gives up or did when the gales of November come early.